Welcome to the NCO Journal's Sergeant Assigned Podcast, featuring informal conversations with leaders at all levels, where you will have the unique chance to learn what makes them tick, what their leadership styles are, and what inspires them. I'm your host, Staff Sergeant Brandon Cox, NCOIC of the NCO Journal. With us is Chago Zapata, the Managing Editor. Today we welcome Navy Commander William C. Spears to our podcast. Commander Spears is a submarine warfare officer in the United States Navy. He enlisted in the Navy in June of 2001, then earned his commission through the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. He was most recently the executive officer of a ballistic missile submarine. Today he works at the Pentagon, and he is the author of the forthcoming book, Stoicism as a Warrior Philosophy. Commander Spears, it's an honor to have you on the show.
Hey guys, really glad to be here. I really appreciate it.
Commander Spears, we're thrilled to have you. If we could, we could start off by talking a little bit about your past. So our first question is kind of, where did you grow up and what was life like there?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in a small town in Louisiana, Pineville, Louisiana, just like a lot of people in the service, landlocked, little area, a little one red light town. Coming up to the end of high school, didn't exactly know what my path to college was going to be. So I joined the Navy. I had both of my grandfathers had served in the Navy and in World War II. And so I thought that would be a good path for me to get some technical training, get some education. And so that's what I did. My dad advised me whenever I did that, hey, if they any chance for you to get school, do the most technical, hardest thing you can and keep doing that and apply for every school that you can. And so I entered into the nuclear power program in the Navy to go and be a technician on a nuclear submarine or aircraft carrier. I went through that school and immediately basically started applying to every option I could find to try to be an officer. And lo and behold, I got picked up for the Naval Academy, and kind of the rest is history from there. Whenever I joined, it was right before, it was actually June of 2001. So that was before September 11th happened. I was in nuclear power school whenever that occurred, which was, kind of a formative event, as I'm sure you can imagine. But that's basically my background. Small town Louisiana, never been a very good country boy, never really into hunting and fishing and, football like most of the guys are. But the kind of technical world of the Navy has worked out really well for me. That's just kind of where I found myself at home.
All right, sir. Tell us what's it like working on a submarine? I mean, what is that life like? I mean, it's okay. I saw The Hunt for Red October was my first experience with nuclear submarines. Having seen that one was, it was exciting. It was all, all action and all that. But I imagine that it's probably nothing like that.
Yeah, give me a ping, Vasily. One ping only. Yeah. It's a very, very technical field. It's very, very busy. I get asked a lot, hey, how do you guys do you lose your mind being, cramped up like that? And honestly, no. People do end up having just like anywhere else in the service, you do have your, and we'll talk about this later, but you do have your people who don't adapt well. But generally, it's more a function of the workload. A nuclear submarine is a very, very maintenance intensive beast to keep running. And I mean, it's basically like you're living inside a machine. And that machine is a very harsh mistress, very constantly demanding your attentions just to keep everything, hold everything together. It's like holding sand in your hands, and that is, it's been like that at every level of my career, where you're just so darn busy, underway that you're not really thinking about, that you're in a tube. Now there are many aspects of that are good and bad. I think more good and bad, that more good than bad for me. I like it's a small community. My crew is never more than 160 people, really. So no matter how high I move up in the chain of command, I still know everybody and I'm still comfortable talking to everybody. And I really like the kind of camaraderie that comes with that. kind of there's a culture in the submarine force that's very very much about dependence on one another and technical competence. You know, the your knowledge of the ship and your understanding and your technical competence is the coin of the realm, and that matters vastly more than anyone's rank or position. Really, you've got to observe the protocols. You've got to hold, you know, you got to hold the line on formality and everything like that. But you got to know what you're talking about. You got to know what you're doing. You got to know what the book says. And everyone is depending on one another. You know, if there's a fire or there's flooding, everyone's running to it. Everyone has to know exactly what to do immediately. And that's just how the world works.
Which makes me wonder, what are some of the unique leadership challenges that you, or maybe let's put it on the NCO side. I'm sure that you saw as the XO of a nuclear submarine, you saw things from the NCO side, you know, from your chief or senior chief or whoever it is who was the senior enlisted advisor or senior enlisted person on the boat. I'm sorry, on the submarine.
Yeah. So our NCO equivalent in the Navy, you know, it's chiefs, and that's at E7 for us, where you know, the NCO, you've got this big divide, and it's kind of storied. The Navy is, I think, more than any of the other services, draws a very distinct social line between the chiefs and junior enlisted. They have this whole ceremony that they go through, and there's no equivalent to it in the officer side, and I don't think the other services do anything like this, but there's this whole kind of rebirth ceremony thing that goes along with being a chief, where you kind of bury your former identity and you have to be this other thing now. And they very quickly, once you promote to that rank, they very quickly shuffle you off to a different ship somewhere where you can kind of start out at that new level. And, you know, I've never been a chief. I can't really speak to it, but I depended on my chiefs very heavily. And that social division has a lot of tradition behind it. It has, you know, it fields some criticism. I think it deserves some criticism. At the same time, it does there's a lot of good to it. And the differences there, and it has nothing to do with privilege. It has everything to do with responsibility, and kind of drawing the line between where, you know, what your level of responsibility is for any problem that happens. Basically, what I've advised my chiefs is, you know, whenever they've made chiefs, is like, okay, that was, you know, yesterday was the last chance that you ever get to say that's not my problem, or that's not my job, or that's not my fault. It's all your fault now, because you are now leadership, and that means it's your responsibility, because we're living inside this metal tube, and we've got to live, you know, and we've got to fix it. Whatever the problem is, we've got to fix it, or it's not going to work out for any of us.
I'm curious, sir, how long do you guys normally spend underway?
There's a lot of confusion around this one. So I think the longest stretch that I've ever been kind of without sunlight, with, you know, between hatch shut to hatch open, has been 70 odd days for me. Some people have gone up to 140, I think, is the record, but it's usually not that long. But that's different from a deployment. So on a typical, like an attack submarine, we'll do a deployment that's nominally 6 months. Maybe that gets extended to 7 or 8 sometimes. But during that period of time, you know, that's whenever they are away from home port, away from family, and you'll do a mission or an operation or something that will keep you submerged for, you know, a few weeks to a month or two at a time. And then you'll pull into port somewhere and restock your food, get some parts, fix some things, and then go back out. You know, you'll be in port for a few days, and then you'll go back out and do it. And you'll do that for about, you know, 6 months. That's a deployment. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily an underway. That's different.
Well, this is actually a good segue for why we're here. Let's talk about the elephant in the room here. What is a Navy submarine officer doing on the NCO Journal Sergeant's Time podcast? Why are we here?
This is an Army podcast?
Yeah.
I thought this was a Navy submarine commander podcast. What am I doing here? I'm lost, you know. This is a leadership podcast, and I like to write and think and talk about leadership. And it's fundamentally the same. The challenges And the principles of leadership are fundamentally the same everywhere. There's going to be little idiosyncratic differences that have to do with culture and have to do with technical requirements of the job that are going to emerge. But the baseline principles are the same everywhere. And, I've listened to your guys' podcast, and I think it's excellent. And the way that you guys interview leaders and you pick their brains about what works for them, what hasn't, what lessons they've learned. And I'm really glad to have the opportunity to talk here. Hey, this reminds me, there's one thing I haven't said before we kind of go further. I do need to mention that anything I say here is my opinion alone and doesn't reflect the opinions of the Department of Defense or any of its components. And if I mention any commercial products or services, that does not imply DoD endorsement. And the presence of any kind of hyperlinks in the show notes doesn't signify DoD approval of any of the linked websites or the content or products or services. That's just one of those things that we have to say. I kind of meant to say it right at the front, and it's important to get out there here at some point.
All right, let's talk about your you like to write. How many books have you written? Let's start with that. are you a number one, or your Stoicism book is something that that's getting ready to come out? But is there have you written other material that deals with leadership?
Yeah, so I've been writing about I kind of started writing about leadership as a junior officer coming off of my first sea tour, and really just kind of you're in this compressed environment, you're learning these lessons constantly, and they're kind of compressing. And for me, writing is kind of an outlet. It's my way of decompressing the things that I've learned and the things that I've thought. So I started off as like a junior officer. I had a blog that the Navy junior officers where it was just like one junior officer to another saying like, hey, you know, here's the lessons I've learned. Here's what's worked for me, you know, and I found that there's a lot of resonance. A lot of people are going to, found value in that. Now with that, there's kind of this hill of modesty you've got to overcome, which I kind of compare it in being willing to put yourself out there as a writer. It's almost like that same hill of overcoming modesty that you got to overcome as you kind of grow in leadership. And I'm sure you guys experienced this as NCOs, and whenever you're training the young bucks, you kind of have to teach them the same thing, is that you have to get over your reluctance to share what you know. And whenever you've got something that you know, you might want to share it, but you might feel reluctant that like, oh, someone's going to think I'm patronizing them, and then I'm trying to get attention here, and they're going to give me crap for that. So I'm not going to be that guy. And it's just something you got to get over, you know, because mentorship is how it's done. And that's where the most important leadership lessons are passed. They're passed orally from experienced guy to inexperienced guy. Like that's the way it's been since the legions, you know. And like we can put all this stuff in a classroom if we want, but if you're not willing to overcome your own modesty and put yourself out there, then a lot is getting left on the table, because there's, you know, what gets learned in the classroom is nothing like what gets learned from just interpersonal, you know, interactions.
Your latest book that you're working on that's getting ready to be released here, it deals with Stoicism. Can you explain that term to us? What exactly does that mean, and why is it relevant to us?
So the title of the book is Stoicism as a Warrior Philosophy. And you never really realize how defiant of an elevator pitch this topic of Stoicism is until you're sitting across the desk from an admiral, and admiral says, you wrote a book on what? So what Stoicism is, it's an ancient philosophy. It's an ancient Greek philosophy that teaches the cultivation of virtue and resilience and emotional control. Specifically by prioritizing your inner moral virtue over all other concerns. It's gaining a lot of traction right now. It's gaining a lot of popularity kind of on the internet and online forums, and a lot of popular books going out there, going around about it. And it's really, people find that it's helping them in a lot of ways. It's about dealing with what I can control. what is specifically within my power or responsibility, and kind of clearing the psychological field of all the other things that are not within my power. And you can kind of see immediately how that resonates with the military service. And in fact, it's been a kind of popular underground thing within the military for a very long time, much longer than the kind of current popular movement. And so I got into this myself and felt that, you know, hey, there's not really a book out there on stoicism and the military service and how those things play together. And so I set out to write it. And it's, you know, it's not like I have a lot of time, or anyone on active duty has a lot of time, but it's something I've been working on for a really long time. So I'm excited. I'm excited that it's coming out. I'm really lucky to have found a publisher, because it's kind of a weird topic, but it's hard to find what shelf does this go on, you know, but I think that it's something that will be valuable to people in the service.
Would you mind placing stoicism in a way that NCOs can find relatable? I mean, you think about what Army NCOs, they have a lot of different fields in the Army, obviously. Think about infantrymen. Some of the guys you might have something in common with are the tankers, you know, because they work inside of a machine as well, a little mm-hmm. smaller than y'all's. And there's also all other kinds of individuals who in the Army. Could you kind of put that more in that kind of perspective, as in the war fighter who's out there on land fighting war, like, for instance, like, say, in Afghanistan, Iraq? How does stoicism come into play when it comes to NCOs with those kind of responsibilities in that kind of environment?
Well, if you've ever had to think about the fact that there's all this stuff that's bothering me that I'm worried about, whether it's I'm afraid for my own physical danger, or, you know, I'm afraid of danger for the people who I care about, or I'm frustrated. More likely I'm frustrated by, you know, something that staff is doing or command is doing, or some decision that's made well above my head, or some change in direction. It's very frustrating, and how that can dominate your thoughts in such a way that it makes it harder for you to do your job. And if it's harder for you to do your job, your people are going to feel that, and the people that you're responsible for are not going to get your best if you are dominated by these emotions and these frustrations or these fears or anger. And what Stoicism does is it is a framework of thinking through those emotions and those thoughts that lead to these kind of destructive ruminations, and nipping them in the bud, and basically shutting them down and focusing on what really matters. So there are, you know, the popular books that are out there on this stuff kind of give it a really very surface treatment. And what I set out to do is, you know, the book is not a light read. You know, it's pretty dense and it's pretty academic, and it goes really, you know, what I set out to do, because there's already a bunch of popular books out there on this topic that, you know, the world didn't need another popular one. I said, okay, I'm gonna follow the rabbit hole down as deep as it goes, and see how far down and deep it goes without getting into something that's a college textbook. Because if, you know, once you know how to speak Greek and you start reading the academic philosophy, which I did for a lot of my research, a lot of it's just kind of incomprehensible if you don't have a PhD. And, I didn't set out to write something that needed a PhD, but I did set out to write something that is relevant to the warfighter and applicable to the job and to the leadership challenges specifically, and the moral challenges that come with that. And I found the philosophy useful in my own job and my own managing my emotions, for whether it's just professionally and just professional stress, or in those kind of emergency situations as well.
And sir, earlier you were talking about you used to spend a lot of time in a submarine, and I'm sure there's a lot of teamwork involved, but there's a lot of other maybe challenges that occur. Can you maybe give us a challenge that happened, and then kind of how you dealt with it, or a lesson learned from it? And then two, if you use stoicism in some way to help you with that, kind of let us in.
Yeah. So there I was on my submarine, and the water starts pouring in, and people are screaming, and I broke out my Marcus Aurelius, and I turned to the passage, and I said, you know, what would Marcus Aurelius tell me to do here? And he said, you're going to die, you idiot. All right. That didn't happen. Cause that's not how it works. All right. But, Marcus Aurelius totally says stuff like that sometimes, maybe not quite in exactly those terms, but if you ever read his work, he thinks a lot about life and death. It's like a subroutine, okay? That kind of, and once you train your mind how to think through emotional challenges and to think about what I am and what I'm not and what is my priority and what is really important and what's not. So a good example, I guess, of how that applies as a subroutine that you know, I'm not going to break out my stoicism book whenever I'm challenged, you know, I don't have time for that. It's just there, but like just a professional, just the regular friction of rank and promotion and living in a competitive environment and seeing this other officer, this other junior officer that is, you know, kind of the butt kisser and seeing him get elevated, you know, and get all the accolades and all the awards. And over here, I'm struggling. I'm doing all this work that no one notices and feeling frustrated by that. And, you know, being able to think through those emotions and saying, okay, all right, these ranks, these awards, this uniform, these things are not what I am. Okay, what I am is my own moral agency, my own moral identity. The recognition of other people, that's an external thing. That's not something I have any power over. It's going to, you know, there's going to be a luck factor in there. And, you know, at the end of the day, maybe that junior officer, once I start thinking about those things, then I can clear the field of all the kind of distracting emotions and all the lies that I'm telling myself and say, you know what, he's probably performing better than me. If I can acknowledge that I'm just being jealous here, you know, and then that opens the door for me to say, what do I need to do better? How do I need to perform better? And it could be that, no, he's just a butt kisser and he's getting elevated for that. And, you know, the leadership above me is, you know, failing to notice that. And if that's the case, then okay, I'll deal with that. I've got to recognize that and put it in a box and say like, all right, well, I have no control over that. I'm going to do my job to the best of my ability. And, you know, my leadership will change, you know, we'll move on. I'll get assigned somewhere else and it'll be fine. And at the end of the day, this, you know, uniform I'm wearing and my promotion and those kinds of outcomes, I can't control them. They're not who I am. They're costumes and they can evaporate at any time for any reason. And so as long as I recognize that my own moral agency is clean, I'm doing the best that I can with what I have. And there's a lot of equanimity that comes with that and a lot of focus and clarity and ability to do my job better, ultimately for my people better.
To me, it seems like it ties to the definition of the actual word stoicism, in a way, you know, you kind of grin and bear it, internalize, but the philosophy behind it is obviously more complex. There's certain things that you have to, that you internalize, that you tell yourself or that you have to, I guess, just develop within your own mind and within your own moral compass. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, and you got to be careful there. There's the Stoic as an adjective, you know, it comes from the reputation of the Stoics as being these kind of stiff-faced, dour intellectuals, you know, but it does not mean unemotional. And whenever you dig into the philosophy, you find that they're very into the ancient Stoics were very into your social roles and your sociability. And they did not believe that the ideal wise person is supposed to be some, you know, disconnected person up on a mountain. You're a part of a society and humans are made for each other and are made to work together. And you know, with that comes some obligations to make it work and to do your part. And part of that's being sociable. Part of that is being a good parent or a good child. You know, if I've got an elderly parent to take care of, I've got a lot of responsibilities to that person, and there's going to be emotions attendant to that. The question of whether an emotion is correct or not depends on whatever the underlying judgment is that is going to lead to it. And that's a psychological process that they you know, kind of inculcated naturally in the way that they reasoned through the way that you should think about things. So, you know, the bottom line there is that stoicism does not equal unemotional. It really is about the domestication of emotions and putting them in their proper place and recognizing them and treating them appropriately.
Let me kind of dig a little more into that myself. I can see exactly what you're saying here, but as far as what that the definition of that word, of that adjective, as you said, one of the things about that NCOs pride themselves on, or good NCOs, is self-reflection.
Uh-huh.
And I think you have to, if you're a good leader and you self-reflect, you're someone who can actually admit if you made a mistake. It doesn't define you. It's something you get past. And then there's the other kinds of individuals who don't self-reflect, that may never admit that they make a mistake because they just don't make mistakes, etc. What I'm saying is there's a lot when it comes to self-reflection, philosophy. There's a tie there. Would you say the same?
Absolutely. And I mean, it's kind of like you said, you know, the guys that don't make mistakes, they're thinking emotionally, you know, and it's the pride, you know, and if you can't get past that pride, and recognize it, and you know, the anger or frustration, whatever, then you're never going to get to the point of correcting what's wrong and getting better. And the guys that are the best are the ones that keep getting better and don't stop, settle for, well, I'm done. I'm good. I don't make mistakes. You know, it's the ones that say I do make mistakes and I'm going to correct them and stop making them, you know. And I tell you what, like I've heard, just on the topic, and this is kind of a tangent, but on the topic of making mistakes, what I've heard moving up in rank is that, you know, as a junior officer, you can make all kinds of mistakes and, you know, it's forgiveness. But as a senior officer, you don't get to make mistakes anymore. That is such crap. You make so many mistakes at every level. And, you know, whenever you go from making 100 important decisions a day to 1,000 important decisions a day, you're going to make more mistakes, and their consequences are going to be better. Now, whenever you move up in rank, you know, the gravity of a lot of your decisions ends up getting higher. And with those really high gravity decisions, you can't mess them up because, you know, if you make a mistake with that, you're done. You know, lives are in danger, and the number of lives that are in danger goes up a lot. And you know, the forgiveness for those kinds of mistakes goes down. But the decisions that I make over the course of a day, every interaction with every sailor that I come across is a decision. And so if there's a guy sweeping on the ladder well, and I just brush by him and bump him, and I'm in too much of a hurry and I'm too busy, and I need to get through this little cramped space, but there's a guy cleaning and I don't show him some kind of courtesy as I brush by him, that was a decision. And that could be a mistake. That could be a grave mistake. That might be the thing that makes the difference between that guy making a recommendation and his next watch that saves the ship or not. You know, those interactions, all of those are decisions, and all of those are opportunities to make mistakes. So I've definitely had it happen where I've been busy and I brushed by a guy and then I've thought, man, that was a mistake. You know, I need to fix myself. And, you know, next opportunity I said to him, Hey brother, whenever I brushed by you yesterday, I appreciate what you're doing. You know, I should have said something then and I didn't. And so I want to let you know that, you know, those little opportunities to correct yourself, that's a very important thing. But it is absolutely not true that, you know, the mistakes go down as you move up. No, the opportunities for the mistakes just go up.
That answer, I think it would probably resonate more with NCOs than some of the other things you talked about, to be honest. The things that NCOs deal with on a day-to-day basis, have more to deal with the personal relationships and the decisions of how you treat your subordinates, you know, when you're stressed out, when you're under pressure for something or another, how you decide to treat that person really can affect the way that the team works, how, you know, maybe the cohesiveness or the way that they think of you. I think a lot of it, you know, how you treat them shows your character and the decisions you make shows. And when you make mistakes and how you react to them, that sets a precedent, sets an example. And especially those soldiers who self-reflect and admit their mistakes, you know, can grow from them and show character with every decision they make.
Yeah, that's how you get better. That's how you become the best, is by recognizing when you've messed up and fixing it.
Okay, so what's the tie between that kind of self-reflection or philosophy and mental health? What is the tie between those two?
So can we agree that there is a mental health crisis in this country? Like, is it affecting you guys in the Army? Because I know it's affecting us in the Navy.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yes. You're losing soldiers to depression, to medical discharge. I bet you're going through that too, right? Or they're yes. coming to you already with all kinds of mental problems. This is not, you know, based on research, this is anecdotal to me, but I think there's periods in history where just the unevenness of human progress causes like these temporary pockets of time and lower quality of life, even though quality of life overall isn't improving. A good example is something like the Industrial Revolution, where wealth is exploding, but we've got, you know, kids in coal mines and stuff, and the pollution, you can't walk around in a heavily industrial city and breathe. I think that we're kind of going, and again, I'm just some bubba from Walmart right now. I think that we're going through something like that in this country. And on a broader scale, on the physical fitness side, you look at high school yearbook from like 1970, you'll notice that probably about 2 to 3 out of 10 people are visibly overweight. And if you look at a high school yearbook from today, you'll notice that about 2 to 3 people out of 10 are not visibly overweight. Okay, we are a physically unfit country right now. And that is a function of the food and the abundance of nutrition. Food is cheap, bad food is cheaper. There's sugar in everything. There's commercial forces at play at that in there. It's not just that people are lazy. Okay, it is harder to be physically fit today than it was 50 years ago. It requires more will and more paying attention to what you're eating and what you're doing than it used to. So I think that, you know, mental health is kind of like that too right now. You're in a more corrosive environment for mental health than you used to be. And that a lot of that, I think, has to do with social forces and the disappearance of those spaces where people used to hang out and the disconnection that comes with everyone kind of disappearing into social media and receiving this, you know, curated stream of perfection that is fake and doesn't satisfy any of those human social needs. And as a result, you know, the Center of Disease Control is citing suicide as a leading cause of death in young people and with rates that are rising, you know, 2.5% year over year. We should just call that completely unacceptable. Like how is that even possible in a society as abundant and wealthy as ours? So what does that have to do with philosophy? What you and I know as psychotherapy is actually called cognitive behavioral therapy, okay? That is what we think of as talk therapy, where a therapist counsels you, sits you down, and helps you think through your emotions and how you think about things and recommends these intervention or mitigation strategies. Hey, instead of thinking about this, maybe think about it like this, identify what, you know, put a name to it, say, oh, I am angry about this thing, you know, or oh, I'm fearful about this thing. And then these other strategies that a therapist will teach a person. Self-care is a huge part of it. Okay. The goal is to teach you strategies that you can take with you and keep doing, thinking about your own thoughts and stop those self-destructive spirals. Well, what is fascinating is that cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, it basically was kind of born in the 20th century, in the early 20th century. It was developed by people who were deeply read in philosophy, specifically Stoic philosophy. And they got their techniques from the Stoics. Now, that doesn't mean that what the Stoics were doing, that they knew that that was cognitive behavioral therapy, or that what therapists do is simply doing Stoicism. It's more like techniques that they just kind of developed and figured out because it made sense to them. And then therapists have kind of adapted them and refined it. For therapists, they're techniques of self-regulation, but for the ancient Stoics, they were just how you should think about things. I think of this comparison as kind of like we understood winemaking before we ever had a microscope and knew anything about microbiology, or centuries before electricity, we figured out that chewing on the bark of a willow tree could cure a headache, but we didn't know why. It's just something that, you know, Indians figured out. But, you know, now we know that the active ingredient of that is salicylic acid, which can be synthesized as aspirin. So that's kind of like the analogy there. These mental techniques that are just healthy modes of thinking are baked into the philosophy, and there's something the philosophy's figured out a long time ago. That, I think, is why Stoicism is catching on as a popular thing. You know, it's not a new phenomenon. It's been on the books forever, you know, and people studying philosophy in college have studied it forever, but it's kind of exploded in like the 2010s. I think it's catching on because as a wider trend, specifically because of the mental health crisis, because people are finding that it helps keep them sane. So hopefully that kind of answers that question.
I would hazard to say, though, that the army community, the kind of mental health issues they have more to do with the operational tempo, deployments, war. There's especially more senior NCOs and senior soldiers. Let's just go with soldiers, not just NCOs, because there's officers and out there as well who I'm sure are suffering from PTSD and things that they dealt with during the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, you know, that I think that's another layer for the military community.
Yeah, and I've got to be 100% on this one. I've never dealt with PTSD. I've had lots of sailors with depression and all the things that are anxiety, all those things. I haven't dealt with PTSD. And it's very important to be clear that you wouldn't prescribe Stoicism to someone who's in need of therapy. No, they need to see a doctor. They need to see a licensed and trained therapist. But as a preventive, I think it can be very helpful.
All right, that kind of leads to the next question here that I have here. What is the warrior philosophy?
The book, I present the case that insofar as there is such a thing as a warrior philosophy, and then Stoicism is as good of a candidate of it for that as you are going to find anywhere. But it'd be worthwhile to just kind of be clear about what I mean by a philosophy. So that's a word that gets bandied about a lot in the military because we talk about a command philosophy, you know, or my philosophy is that leaders should eat last. So I argue, and I kind of, you know, if you're writing like a philosopher, you got to set out your terms and clarify what you mean early on. So I kind of set out kind of an intro that when I say the word philosophy, that's not what I'm talking about. Like that's a principle or a guideline or something like that. That's not a philosophy. A philosophy is an interlocking set of ideas. And a good way to kind of clarify the difference here is how these words are often used interchangeably. We talk about things like a warrior ethos or a warrior code or a creed. And we find all the time that we use these words interchangeably, but they do mean different things, okay? And I think that each one of those things is useful, but they are different, okay? So an ethos, warrior ethos is something that emerges naturally. It's like this naturally emerging spirit, values, beliefs that define a particular group or culture. Such as for a warrior ethos, things like selflessness, tenacity, loyalty. The key point that separates an ethos from these other things is it's not artificial. It's not something that you can create or impose. You can try, go for it. let me know how it works out for you. You know, an ethos is something that just emerges. It's part of culture. Okay. It's a function of culture that's going to, you know, and the word ethos has been what it is, for centuries, thousands of years, because of the nature of the job. It's not something anyone just decided, this is what we're going to name this ethos, and now everyone's going to have it. A code, on the other hand, is different from that. A code is a formal set of rules or guidelines that you lay out. So think of like the code of conduct of the armed forces. You know, I will never surrender of my own free will, is one of those statements. That's an article of the code of conduct. A creed is kind of similar to a code, but it's made to be a repeatable oath. That's its basic purpose is meant to crystallize the shared identity. You know, so let's say like the NCO creed, all soldiers are entitled to outstanding leadership, and I will provide that leadership. Like, there's a reason that we make people repeat that, is part of, you know, we're driving them to crystallize that identity and to take that on. So all those things are different, even though they're sometimes used interchangeably. They're all useful. I say that a philosophy exists on that same spectrum, kind of at the end of it, as a, you know, if you lay those things out as an increasingly complex way of thinking about things, a philosophy is a broader approach that, you know, potentially even could incorporate fundamental ideas about psychology, ethics, and even the nature of reality. The point of it is that it gets at the whys. It uses the faculty of reason, this fundamental human capability that we have to reason through things, to ask the question of why, and to get at that. So why one should be selfless and tenacious, why one should never surrender, or why one should provide outstanding leadership. I argue that to be properly a warrior philosophy, it should get at those whys.
One of the things that you asked about, or that came up, was also just war theory. Can you talk about that and what it means to NCOs?
Yeah, so if I said to you, Staff Sergeant, all war is evil, and anyone who participates it or abets it is an accomplice to evil. That's my opinion. That's my philosophy. What would you say to that? What do you think?
I'd say that's unfortunate for me.
For
all of us. Yeah.
Well, do you agree?
I don't necessarily agree. I don't know. I don't know if I'm allowed to say my opinion on this, actually. But regardless of what religion or whatever you believe, evil sways differently on the scale of what's right and wrong, right?
Yeah.
And then going to war, taking another's life, has, I guess, I don't know if it's necessarily evil, but it could make you feel awful about it.
Let me put it on my terms too. I at one point I squeezed the trigger aiming at somebody who was aiming at me.
Right.
You know, somebody was firing at me, and it was, am I evil because I'm defending myself, or I'm defending my team, or my Marines? Because I was, by the way, I retired from the Marine Corps, so that's
okay.
You know, does that make me evil? And I don't think I would disagree with that statement 100%.
Well, I would too. Okay. So let's just be clear on that. But my point is that if you're going to answer the question of why is that not evil? That is immediately taking you into this world of just war theory. And so it's kind of a thing that people, it's a very old line of questioning that goes back to the Middle Ages, where and really it traces back to the old Catholics like St. Augustine and, you know, Thomas Aquinas and these guys, these medieval philosophers that are trying to reason through, you know, this war thing is a horrible thing, but is it ever justified? And I think you have to say yes. And that's what they would say is, you know, we can't just be pacifists, because pacifism, you know, or just saying like all war is evil, I'm never going to do that, that immediately gets you into different moral problems, such as free riding, or, you know, deflecting, you know, moral and physical burdens onto others, or, you know, pacifism prevents you from stopping a worse outcome than the war itself. So pacifism certainly didn't do anything to prevent the rise of Hitler. Or you take like the genocides in 1994 in Rwanda, where the United States was criticized very, very harshly for not stepping in to stop that genocide. And you could argue that, well, pacifism didn't, you know, if we were pacifists, we would definitely not do that. But, you know, the kind of the point is that if you're going to live in...
was evil.
Yeah, in that case, yeah, yeah. So it's basically it's not a morally perfect way to approach anything. You've got to deal with the real world as it exists. So these old philosophers back in the Middle Ages kind of reasoned through all this and came up with these ideas of, you know, a war must be entered for just cause with right intention. We should exercise things like proportionality and non-combatant discrimination. All these things have kind of become what we now know as the law of armed conflict. They've gotten baked into all that, that thinking. But that original thinking of, is war ever justified? And coming to the answer of yes and saying, okay, well, let's reason, let's figure out when it is justified and why it is justified, that is just war thinking. And so the tradition of just war basically breaks it up into the perspective of the country and the individual soldier. And so what you call those terms are called jus ad bellum and jus in bello, or, you know, jus is spelled just, J-U-S. So it means justice in going to war and justice in war. And so the country is responsible to go to war for good reasons and not, you know, just to get defense contractors rich or go get the oil or whatever your theory is. The thing, it should, you know, protect an ally or, you know, stop a terrible, worst thing from happening. The individual soldier is responsible to exercise non-combatant discrimination and proportionality, you know, not to go around slaughtering civilians just because it's convenient. That is the warrior's responsibility, and that is jus in bello, or justice in war. And that's like old. That's traditional just war theory. It's typically credited to the Catholics I mentioned earlier. But the fascinating thing is, if you trace that further back, they were reading the Stoics. A lot of their ideas they got from this guy named Cicero, who was a Roman who was reading the what are called the Middle Stoics of Panaetius and Posidonius. I don't think that anyone really cares about that, but that's just trivia. But the, you know, the point is that just war theory is a thing that, you know, all of your JOs studied in college at some point, and you know, but that actually traces back to the same guys that I write about.
So what does that have to do with NCOs though? What is the significance?
Well, as an NCO, you're a soldier, so you need to behave with justice in war, and typically. A lot of that is taken care of in the imperative to follow lawful orders, and the laws that define those orders are informed by just war theory. I think that it is relevant just to kind of understand that stuff has been thought through as an NCO, and as part of knowing your why. Knowing that there is a why and thinking through it of, you know, if someone is to say like all war is evil and anyone who would participate in it or who put on a uniform is, you know, abetting this terrible evil thing, being able to think through like, no, this has been thought through. This is not just a thing that that I'm doing because it pays for college, you know, and it's actually this evil that I'm just tolerating. Like, there's good reasons to do these things.
Okay, sir. So as the final question we ask all of our guests on the Sergeant's Time podcast is, what advice would present day you give to Petty Officer Spears back in the day?
Take every opportunity that you can to learn, whether that is through formal learning, taking every opportunity to go to school, go to a class, or improve yourself that way, or in your own personal time. You got to do both. And when you are going through that formal learning process, follow the rabbit holes that interest you and do the learning on your own as well. So I am, you know, in all the, I've been through a lot of school. In all of that school, I've learned at least as much from the stuff that I've followed out on my own. And I'm typically a B student, you know, for that reason, because, you know, thermodynamics is cool and everything, but this, you know, this morality of war thing over here is pretty interesting too. So I'm going to kind of dig into that a little bit. So following the intellectual rabbit holes whenever they come up and exploring them to the maximum extent possible, but always be learning. Always.
Commander Spears, thank you for joining us. Stay tuned for more interesting guests and inspiring conversations right here at the NCO Journal. Submit your articles, get published. Don't forget to check out our webpage and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time on the Sergeant's Time Podcast.